Macmillan Audio presents The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. Read for you by Polly Stone. Chapter 1. April 9th, 1995. The Oregon Coast. If I have learned anything in this long life of mine, it is this. In love, we find out who we want to be. In war, we find out who we are. Today's young people want to know everything about everyone. They think talking about a problem will solve it. I come from a quieter generation. We understand the value of forgetting, the lure of reinvention. Lately, though, I find myself thinking about the war and my past, about the people I lost. Lost. It makes it sound as if I misplaced my loved ones. Perhaps I left them where they don't belong and then turned away, too confused to retrace my steps. They are not lost, nor are they in a better place. They are gone. As I approach the end of my years, I know that grief, like regret, settles into our DNA and remains forever a part of us. I have aged in the months since my husband's death and my diagnosis. My skin has the crinkled appearance of wax paper that someone has tried to flatten and reuse. My eyes fail me often, in the darkness, when headlights flash, when rain falls. It is unnerving, this new unreliability in my vision. Perhaps that's why I find myself looking backward. The past has a clarity I can no longer see in the present. I want to imagine there will be peace when I am gone, that I will see all of the people I have loved and lost, at least that I will be forgiven. I know better, though, don't I? My house, named The Peaks by the lumber baron who built it over 100 years ago, is for sale, and I am preparing to move because my son thinks I should. He is trying to take care of me, to show how much he loves me in this most difficult of times, and so I put up with his controlling ways. What do I care where I die? That is the point, really. It no longer matters where I live. I am boxing up the Oregon beachside life I settled into nearly 50 years ago. There is not much I want to take with me. But there is one thing. I reach for the hanging handle that controls the attic steps. The stairs unfold from the ceiling, like a gentleman extending his hand. The flimsy stairs wobble beneath my feet as I climb into the attic, which smells of must and mold. A single hanging light bulb swings overhead. I pull the cord. It's like being in the hold of an old steamship. Wide wooden planks panel the walls. Cobwebs turn the creases silver and hang in skeins from the indentation between the planks. The ceiling is so steeply pitched that I can stand upright only in the center of the room. I see the rocking chair I used when my grandchildren were young, then an old crib and a ratty-looking rocking horse set on rusty springs, and the chair my daughter was refinishing when she got sick. Boxes are tucked along the wall, marked Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, Halloween, serveware, sports, In those boxes are the things I don't use much anymore, but can't bear to part with. For me, admitting that I won't decorate a tree for Christmas is giving up, and I've never been good at letting go. Tucked in the corner is what I am looking for. An ancient steamer trunk covered in travel stickers. With effort, I drag the heavy trunk to the center of the attic, directly beneath the hanging light. I kneel beside it, but the pain in my knees is piercing, so I slide onto my backside. For the first time in 30 years, I lift the trunk's lid. The top tray is full of baby memorabilia. Tiny shoes, ceramic hand molds, crayon drawings populated by stick figures and smiling suns, report cards, dance recital pictures. I lift the tray from the trunk and set it aside. The mementos in the bottom of the trunk are in a messy pile. Several faded leather-bound journals, a packet of aged postcards tied together with a blue satin ribbon, a cardboard box bent in one corner, a set of slim books of poetry by Julien Rossignol, and a shoebox that holds hundreds of black-and-white photographs. On top is a yellowed, faded piece of paper. My hands are shaking as I pick it up. It is a carte d'identité, an identity card from the war. I see the small, passport-sized photo of a young woman, Juliette Gervais. "Mom?" I hear my son on the creaking wooden steps, footsteps that match my heartbeats. Has he called out to me before? "Mom, you shouldn't be up here. Shit, the steps are unsteady." He comes to stand beside me. "One fall and..." I touch his pant leg, shake my head softly. I can't look up. "Don't," is all I can say. He kneels, then sits. I can smell his aftershave, something subtle and spicy, and also a hint of smoke. He has sneaked a cigarette outside, a habit he gave up decades ago and took up again at my recent diagnosis. There is no reason to voice my disapproval. He is a doctor. He knows better. My instinct is to toss the card into the trunk and slam the lid down, hiding it again. It's what I have done all my life. Now I am dying. Not quickly, perhaps, but not slowly either, and I feel compelled to look back on my life. "Mom, you're crying." "Am I?" I want to tell him the truth, but I can't. It embarrasses and shames me, this failure. At my age, I should not be afraid of anything, certainly not my own past. I say only, "I want to take this trunk." "It's too big. I'll repack the things you want into a smaller box." I smile at his attempt to control me. "I love you, and I am sick again. For these reasons, I have let you push me around, but I am not dead yet. I want this trunk with me." "What can you possibly need in it? It's just our artwork and other junk." If I had told him the truth long ago, or had danced and drunk and sung more, maybe he would have seen me instead of a dependable, ordinary mother. He loves a version of me that is incomplete. I always thought it was what I wanted, to be loved and admired. Now I think perhaps I'd like to be known. Think of this as my last request. I can see that he wants to tell me not to talk that way. but he's afraid his voice will catch. He clears his throat. You've beaten it twice before. You'll beat it again. We both know this isn't true. I am unsteady and weak. I can neither sleep nor eat without the help of medical science. Of course I will. I just want to keep you safe. I smile. Americans can be so naive. Once I shared his optimism, I thought the world was safe. But that was a long time ago. Who is Juliette Gervais? Julien says, and it shocks me a little to hear that name from him. I close my eyes, and in the darkness that smells of mildew and bygone lives, my mind casts back, a line thrown across years and continents. Against my will, or maybe in tandem with it, who knows anymore, I remember. Chapter 2. The lights are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. Sir Edward Grey on World War I. August 1939. France. Vianne Mauriac left the cool, stucco-walled kitchen and stepped out into her front yard. On this beautiful summer morning in the Loire Valley, everything was in bloom. White sheets flapped in the breeze, and roses tumbled like laughter along the ancient stone wall that hid her property from the road. A pair of industrious bees buzzed among the blooms. From far away, she heard the chugging purr of a train and then the sweet sound of a little girl's laughter. Sophie. Vianne smiled. Her 8-year-old daughter was probably running through the house, making her father dance attendance on her as they readied for their Saturday picnic.
Your daughter is a tyrant,
Antoine said, appearing in the doorway. He walked toward her, his pomaded hair glinting black in the sunlight. He'd been working on his furniture this morning, sanding a chair that was already as soft as satin, and a fine layer of wood dust peppered his face and shoulders. He was a big man, tall and broad-shouldered, with a rough face and a dark stubble that took constant effort to keep from becoming a beard. He slipped an arm around her and pulled her close.
I love you, V.
I love you, too.
It was the truest fact of her world. She loved everything about this man, his smile, the way he mumbled in his sleep and laughed after a sneeze and sang opera in the shower. She'd fallen in love with him 15 years ago, on the school playyard, before she'd even known what love was. He was her first everything. First kiss, first love, first lover. Before him, she'd been a skinny, awkward, anxious girl, given to stuttering when she got scared, which was often. A motherless girl.
You will be the adult now,
her father had said to Vianne, as they walked up to this very house for the first time. She'd been 14 years old, her eyes swollen from crying, her grief unbearable. In an instant, this house had gone from being the family summer house to a prison of sorts. Maman had been dead less than 2 weeks when Papa gave up on being a father. Upon their arrival here, he'd not held her hand, or rested a hand on her shoulder, or even offered her a handkerchief to dry her tears.
But I'm just a girl, she'd said.
Not anymore.
She'd looked down at her younger sister, Isabel, who still sucked her thumb at 4 and had no idea what was going on. Isabel kept asking when Maman was coming home. When the door opened, a tall, thin woman with a nose like a water spigot and eyes as small and dark as raisins appeared.
These are the girls,
the woman had said. Papa nodded.
They will be no trouble.
It had happened so fast. Vian hadn't really understood. Papa dropped off his daughters like soiled laundry and left them with a stranger. The girls were so far apart in age, it was as if they were from different families. Vian had wanted to comfort Isabel, meant to, but Vian had been in so much pain it was impossible to think of anyone else, especially a child as willful and impatient and loud as Isabel. Vian still remembered those first days here, Isabel shrieking and Madame spanking her. Vian had pleaded with her sister, saying again and again,
"Mon Dieu, Isabel, quit screeching. Just do as she bids."
But even at 4, Isabel had been unmanageable. Vian had been undone by all of it, the grief for her dead mother, the pain of her father's abandonment, the sudden change in their circumstances, and Isabel's cloying, needy loneliness. It was Antoine who'd saved Vian. That first summer, after Maman's death, the two of them had become inseparable. With him, Vian had found an escape. By the time she was 16, she was pregnant. At 17, she was married and the mistress of Le Jardin. 2 months later, she had a miscarriage, and she lost herself for a while. There was no other way to put it. She'd crawled into her grief and cocooned it around her, unable to care about anyone or anything, certainly not a needy, wailing 4-year-old sister. But that was old news, not the sort of memory she wanted on a beautiful day like today. She leaned against her husband as their daughter ran up to them, announcing,
"I'm ready, let's go."
"Well," Antoine said, grinning, "the princess is ready, and so we must move."
Vian smiled as she went back into the house and retrieved her hat from the hook by the door. A strawberry blonde, with porcelain-thin skin and sea-blue eyes, she always protected herself from the sun. By the time she'd settled the wide-brimmed straw hat in place and collected her lacy gloves and picnic basket, Sophie and Antoine were already outside the gate. Vian joined them on the dirt road in front of their home. It was barely wide enough for an automobile. Beyond it stretched acres of hayfields, the green here and there studded with red poppies and blue cornflowers. Forests grew in patches. In this corner of the Loire Valley, fields were more likely to be growing hay than grapes. Although less than 2 hours from Paris by train, it felt like a different world altogether. Few tourists visited, even in the summer. Now and then an automobile rumbled past, or a bicyclist, or an ox-driven cart, but for the most part, they were alone on the road. They lived nearly a mile from Carrevaux, a town of less than 1,000 souls that was known mostly as a stopping point on the pilgrimage of Saint Jeanne d'Arc. There was no industry in town and few jobs, except for those at the airfield that was the pride of Carrevaux, the only one of its kind for miles. In town, narrow cobblestone streets wound through ancient limestone buildings that leaned clumsily against one another. Mortar crumbled from stone walls. Ivy hid the decay that lay beneath, unseen but always felt. The village had been cobbled together piecemeal, crooked streets, uneven steps, blind alleys, over hundreds of years. Colors enlivened the stone buildings. Red awnings ribbed in black metal, ironwork balconies decorated with geraniums in terracotta planters. Everywhere there was something to tempt the eye, a display case of pastel macarons, rough willow baskets filled with cheese and ham and saucisson, crates of colorful tomatoes and aubergines and cucumbers. The cafes were full on this sunny day. Men sat around metal tables, drinking coffee and smoking hand-rolled brown cigarettes and arguing loudly. A typical day in Carrevaux. Monsieur Lachaud was sweeping the street in front of his saladerie, and Madame Clonet was washing the window of her hat shop, and a pack of adolescent boys were strolling through town, shoulder to shoulder, kicking bits of trash and passing a cigarette back and forth. At the end of town, they turned toward the river. At a flat, grassy spot along the shore, Vian set down her basket and spread out a blanket in the shade of a chestnut tree. From the picnic basket, she withdrew a crusty baguette, a wedge of rich double cream cheese, two apples, some slices of paper-thin Bayonne ham, and a bottle of Bollinger 36. She poured her husband a glass of champagne and sat down beside him as Sophie ran toward the riverbank. The day passed in a haze of sunshine-warmed contentment. They talked and laughed and shared their picnic. It wasn't until late in the day, when Sophie was off with her fishing pole and Antoine was making their daughter a crown of daisies, that he said, "Hitler will suck us all into his war soon." War. It was all anyone could talk about these days, and Vian didn't want to hear it, especially not on this lovely summer day. She tended a hand across her eyes and stared at her daughter. Beyond the river, the green Loire Valley lay cultivated with care and precision. There were no fences, no boundaries, just miles of rolling green fields and patches of trees and the occasional stone house or barn. Tiny white blossoms floated like bits of cotton in the air. She got to her feet and clapped her hands.
"Come, Sophie, it's time to go home."
"You can't ignore this, Vian."
"Should I look for trouble? Why? You are here to protect us." Smiling, too brightly perhaps, she packed up the picnic and gathered her family and led them back to the dirt road. In less than 30 minutes, they were at the sturdy wooden gate of Le Jardin, the stone country house that had been in her family for 300 years. Aged to a dozen shades of gray, it was a two-story house with blue shuttered windows that overlooked the orchard. Ivy climbed up the two chimneys and covered the bricks beneath. Only 7 acres of the original parcel were left. The other 200 had been sold off over the course of 2 centuries as her family's fortune dwindled. 7 acres was plenty for Vian. She couldn't imagine needing more. Vian closed the door behind them. In the kitchen, copper and cast iron pots and pans hung from an iron rack above the stove. Lavender and rosemary and thyme hung in drying bunches from the exposed timber beams of the ceiling. A copper sink, green with age, was big enough to bathe a small dog in. The plaster on the interior walls was peeling here and there to reveal paint from years gone by. The living room was an eclectic mix of furniture and fabrics, tapestried settee, Aubusson rugs, antique Chinese porcelain, chintz, and toile. Some of the paintings on the wall were excellent, perhaps important, and some were amateurish. It had the jumbled, cobbled-together look of lost money and bygone taste, a little shabby, but comfortable. She paused in the salon, glancing through the glass-paned doors that led to the backyard, where Antoine was pushing Sophie on the swing he'd made for her. Vian hung her hat gently on the hook by the door and retrieved her apron, tying it in place. While Sophie and Antoine played outside, Vian cooked supper. She wrapped a pink pork tenderloin in thick-cut bacon, tied it in twine, and browned it in hot oil. While the pork roasted in the oven, she made the rest of the meal. At 8 o'clock, right on time, she called everyone to supper and couldn't help smiling at the thundering of feet and the chatter of conversation and the squealing of chair legs scraping across the floor as they sat down. Sophie sat at the head of the table, wearing the crown of daisies Antoine had made for her at the riverbank. Vian set down the platter, whose fragrance wafted upward, roasted pork and crispy bacon and apples glazed in a rich wine sauce, resting on a bed of browned potatoes. Beside it was a bowl of fresh peas, swimming in butter seasoned with tarragon from the garden. And of course there was the baguette Vianne had made yesterday morning. As always, Sophie talked all through supper. She was like her Tante Isabel in that way, a girl who couldn't hold her tongue. When at last they came to dessert, Île Flottante, islands of toasted meringue floating in a rich crème anglaise, there was a satisfied silence around the table. "Well," Vianne said at last, pushing her half-empty dessert plate away, "it's time to do the dishes."
"Oh, Maman,"
Sophie whined.
"No whining," Antoine said, "not at your age."
Vianne and Sophie went into the kitchen, as they did each night, to their stations. Vianne at the deep copper sink, Sophie at the stone counter, and began washing and drying the dishes. Vianne could smell the sweet, sharp scent of Antoine's after-supper cigarette wafting through the house.
"Papa didn't laugh at a single one of my stories today,"
Sophie said as Vianne placed the dishes back in the rough wooden rack that hung on the wall.
"Something is wrong with him."
"No laughter? Well, certainly that is cause for alarm."
"He's worried about the war."
The war. Again. Vianne shooed her daughter out of the kitchen. Upstairs, in Sophie's bedroom, Vianne sat on the double bed, listening to her daughter chatter as she put on her pajamas and brushed her teeth and got into bed. Vianne leaned down to kiss her goodnight.
"I'm scared,"
Sophie said.
"Is war coming?"
"Don't be afraid," Vianne said. "Papa will protect us."
But even as she said it, she remembered another time when her maman had said to her, "Don't be afraid." It was when her own father had gone off to war. Sophie looked unconvinced.
But
nothing. There is nothing to worry about. Now go to sleep.
She kissed her daughter again, letting her lips linger on the little girl's cheek. Vianne went down the stairs and headed for the backyard. Outside, the night was sultry. The air smelled of jasmine. She found Antoine sitting in one of the iron cafe chairs out on the grass, his legs stretched out, his body slumped uncomfortably to one side. She came up beside him, put a hand on his shoulder. He exhaled smoke and took another long drag on the cigarette. Then he looked up at her. In the moonlight, his face appeared pale and shadowed, almost unfamiliar. He reached into the pocket of his vest and pulled out a piece of paper.
"I have been mobilized, Vianne, along with most men between 18 and 35.
"Mobilized? But we are not at war.
I am to report for duty on Tuesday."
But you're a postman."
He held her gaze, and suddenly she couldn't breathe.
"I am a soldier now, it seems."
Chapter 3 Vianne knew something of war. Not its clash and clatter and smoke and blood, perhaps, but the aftermath. Though she had been born in peacetime, her earliest memories were of the war. She remembered watching her maman cry as she said goodbye to papa. She remembered being hungry and always being cold. But most of all, she remembered how different her father was when he came home, how he limped and sighed and was silent. That was when he began drinking and keeping to himself and ignoring his family. After that, she remembered doors slamming shut, arguments erupting and disappearing into clumsy silences, and her parents sleeping in different rooms. The father who went off to war was not the one who came home. She had tried to be loved by him. More important, she had tried to keep loving him. But in the end, one was as impossible as the other. In the year since he'd shipped her off to Carivaux, Vianne had made her own life. She sent her father Christmas and birthday cards, but she'd never received one in return, and they rarely spoke. What was there left to say? Unlike Isabel, who seemed incapable of letting go, Vian understood and accepted that when Maman had died, their family had been irreparably broken. He was a man who simply refused to be a father to his children.
"I know how war scares you," Antoine said.
"The Maginot line will hold," she said,
trying to sound convincing.
"You'll be home by Christmas."
The Maginot line was miles and miles of concrete walls and obstacles and weapons that had been constructed along the German border after the Great War to protect France. The Germans couldn't breach it. Antoine took her in his arms. The scent of jasmine was intoxicating, and she knew suddenly, certainly, that from now on, whenever she smelled jasmine, she would remember this goodbye.
"I love you, Antoine Mauriac, and I expect you to come home to me."
Later, she couldn't remember them moving into the house, climbing the stairs, lying down in bed, undressing each other. She remembered only being naked in his arms, lying beneath him as he made love to her in a way he never had before, with frantic, searching kisses and hands that seemed to want to tear her apart even as they held her together.
"You're stronger than you think you are, V,"
he said afterward, when they lay quietly in each other's arms.
"I'm not,"
she whispered too quietly for him to hear. The next morning, Vian wanted to keep Antoine in bed all day, maybe even convince him that they should pack their bags and run like thieves in the night. But where would they go? War hung over all of Europe. By the time she finished making breakfast and doing the dishes, a headache throbbed at the base of her skull.
"You seem sad, Maman,"
Sophie said.
"How can I be sad on a gorgeous summer's day when we are going to visit our best friends?"
Vian smiled a bit too brightly. It wasn't until she was out the front door and standing beneath one of the apple trees in the front yard that she realized she was barefoot.
"Maman,"
Sophie said impatiently.
"I'm coming,"
she said, as she followed Sophie through the front yard, past the old dovecote, now a gardening shed, and the empty barn. Sophie opened the back gate and ran into the well-tended neighboring yard, toward a small stone cottage with blue shutters. Sophie knocked once, got no answer, and went inside.
"Sophie!"
Vian said sharply, but her admonishment fell on deaf ears. Manners were unnecessary at one's best friend's house, and Rachel de Champlain had been Vian's best friend for 15 years. They'd met only a month after Papa had so ignominiously dropped his children off at Le Jardin. They'd been a pair back then, Vian, slight and pale and nervous, and Rachel, as tall as the boys, with eyebrows that grew faster than a lie and a voice like a foghorn. Outsiders, both of them, until they met. They'd become inseparable in school and stayed friends in all the years since. They'd gone to university together, and both had become school teachers. They'd even been pregnant at the same time. Now they taught in side-by-side classrooms at the local school. Rachel appeared in the open doorway, holding her newborn son, Ariel. A look passed between them. In it was everything they felt and feared. Vian followed her friend into a small, brightly lit interior that was neat as a pin. A vase full of wildflowers graced the rough wooden trestle table, flanked by mismatched chairs. In the corner of the dining room was a leather valise, and sitting on top of it was the brown felt fedora that Rachel's husband Mark favored. Rachel went into the kitchen for a small crockery plate full of cannelé. Then the women headed outside. In the small backyard, roses grew along a privet hedge. A table and four chairs sat unevenly on a stone patio. Antique lanterns hung from the branches of a chestnut tree. Vian picked up a cannelé and took a bite, savoring the vanilla-rich cream center and crispy, slightly burnt-tasting exterior. She sat down. Rachel sat down across from her, with the baby asleep in her arms. Silence seemed to expand between them and fill with their fears and misgivings.
"I wonder if he'll know his father," Rachel said, as she looked down at her baby.
"They'll be changed," Vian said, remembering. Her father had been in the Battle of the Somme, in which more than 750,000 men had lost their lives. Rumors of German atrocities had come home with the few who survived. Rachel moved the infant to her shoulder, patted his back soothingly.
"Mark is no good at changing diapers, and Ari loves to sleep in our bed. I guess that'll be all right now."
Vianne felt a smile start. It was a little thing, this joke, but it helped.
"Antoine's snoring is a pain in the backside. I should get some good sleep."
"And we can have poached eggs for supper."
"Only half the laundry," she said, but then her voice broke. "I'm not strong enough for this, Rachel."
"Of course you are. We'll get through it together."
"Before I met Antoine..."
Rachel waved a hand dismissively.
"I know, I know. You were as skinny as a branch. You stuttered when you got nervous, and you were allergic to everything. I know. I was there. But that's all over now. You'll be strong. You know why?"
"Why?"
Rachel's smile faded.
"I know I'm big. Statuesque, as they like to say when they're selling me brassieres and stockings. But I feel undone by this, V. And I'm going to need to lean on you sometimes, too. Not with all my weight, of course."
"So we can't both fall apart at the same time."
"Voila," Rachel said. "Our plan. Should we open a bottle of cognac now, or gin?"
"It's 10 o'clock in the morning."
"You're right. Of course. A French 75.
On Tuesday morning, when Vianne awoke, sunlight poured through the window, glazing the exposed timbers. Antoine sat in the chair by the window, a walnut rocker he'd made during Vianne's second pregnancy. For years, that empty rocker had mocked them. The miscarriage years, as she thought of them now. Desolation in a land of plenty. 3 lost lives in 4 years. Tiny, thready heartbeats, blue hands, and then, miraculously, a baby who survived. Sophie. There were sad little ghosts caught in the wood grain of that chair, but there were good memories, too.
"Maybe you should take Sophie to Paris," he said as she sat up. "Julian would look out for you."
"My father has made his opinion on living with his daughters quite clear. I cannot expect a welcome from him."
Vianne pushed the matelassé coverlet aside and rose, putting her bare feet on the worn rug.
"Will you be all right?"
"Sophie and I will be fine. You'll be home in no time anyway. The Maginot Line will hold. And Lord knows the Germans are no match for us."
"Too bad their weapons are. I took all of our money out of the bank. There are 65,000 francs in the mattress. Use it wisely, Vianne. Along with your teaching salary, it should last you a good long time."
She felt a flutter of panic. She knew too little about their finances. Antoine handled them. He stood up slowly and took her in his arms. She wanted to bottle how safe she felt in this moment, so she could drink of it later, when loneliness and fear left her parched.
"Remember this," she thought. The way the light caught in his unruly hair, the love in his brown eyes, the chapped lips that had kissed her only an hour ago in the darkness.
Through the open window behind them, she heard the slow, even clop, clop, clop of a horse moving up the road, and the clattering of the wagon being pulled along behind. That would be Monsieur Kian on his way to market with his flowers. If she were in the yard, he would stop and give her one, and say it couldn't match her beauty, and she would smile and say, "Merci," and offer him something to drink. Vian pulled away reluctantly. She went over to the wooden dresser and poured tepid water from the blue crockery pitcher into the bowl and washed her face. In the alcove that served as their wardrobe, behind a pair of gold and white toile curtains, she put on her brassiere and stepped into her lace-trimmed drawers and garter. She smoothed the silk stockings up her legs, fastened them to her garters, and then slipped into a belted cotton frock with a squared yoke collar. When she closed the curtains and turned around, Antoine was gone. She retrieved her handbag and went down the hallway to Sophie's room. Like theirs, it was small, with a steeply pitched timbered ceiling, wide plank wooden floors, and a window that overlooked the orchard. An ironwork bed, a nightstand with a hand-me-down lamp, and a blue-painted armoire filled the space. Sophie's drawings decorated the walls. Vian opened the shutters and let light flood the room. As usual in the hot summer months, Sophie had kicked the coverlet to the floor sometime in the night. Her pink stuffed teddy bear, Bébé, slept against her cheek. Vian picked up the bear, staring down at its matted, much petted face. Last year, Bébé had been forgotten on a shelf by the window as Sophie moved on to newer toys. Now, Bébé was back. Vian leaned down to kiss her daughter's cheek. Sophie rolled over and blinked awake.
"I don't want Papa to go, Maman," she whispered.
She reached out for Bébé, practically snatched the bear from Vian's hands. "I know," Vian sighed. "I know." Vian went to the armoire, where she picked out the sailor dress that was Sophie's favorite.
"Can I wear the daisy crown Papa made me?"
The daisy crown lay crumpled on the nightstand, the little flowers wilted. Vian picked it up gently and placed it on Sophie's head. Vian thought she was doing all right, until she stepped into the living room and saw Antoine.
"Papa?"
Sophie touched the wilted daisy crown uncertainly.
"Don't go."
Antoine knelt down and drew Sophie into his embrace.
"I have to be a soldier to keep you and Maman safe. But I'll be back before you know it."
Vian heard the crack in his voice. Sophie drew back. The daisy crown was sagging down the side of her head.
"You promise you'll come home?"
Antoine looked past his daughter's earnest face to Vian's worried gaze.
"Oui,"
he said at last. Sophie nodded. The three of them were silent as they left the house. They walked hand in hand up the hillside to the gray wooden barn. Knee-high golden grass covered the knoll, and lilac bushes as big as hay wagons grew along the perimeter of the property. Three small white crosses were all that remained in this world to mark the babies Vian had lost. Today, she didn't let her gaze linger there at all. Her emotions were heavy enough right now. She couldn't add the weight of those memories, too. Inside the barn sat their old green Renault. When they were all in the automobile, Antoine started up the engine, backed out of the barn, and drove on browning ribbons of dead grass to the road. Vian stared out the small, dusty window, watching the green valley pass in a blur of familiar images. Red tile roofs, stone cottages, fields of hay and grapes, spindly-treed forests. All too quickly, they arrived at the train station near Tours. The platform was filled with young men carrying suitcases and women kissing them goodbye and children crying. A generation of men were going off to war. Again.
"Don't think about it," Vian told herself. "Don't remember what it was like last time, when the men limped home, faces burned, missing arms and legs."
Vian clung to her husband's hand as Antoine bought their tickets and led them onto the train. in the third-class carriage, stiflingly hot, people packed in like marsh reeds, she sat stiffly upright, still holding her husband's hand, with her handbag on her lap. At their destination, a dozen or so men disembarked. Vianne and Sophie and Antoine followed the others down a cobblestone street and into a charming village that looked like most small communes in Touraine. How was it possible that war was coming, and that this quaint town with its tumbling flowers and crumbling walls was amassing soldiers to fight? Antoine tugged at her hand, got her moving again. When had she stopped? Up ahead, a set of tall, recently erected iron gates had been bolted into stone walls. Behind them were rows of temporary housing. The gates swung open. A soldier on horseback rode out to greet the new arrivals, his leather saddle creaking at the horse's steps, his face dusty and flushed from heat. He pulled on the reins and the horse halted, throwing its head and snorting. An aeroplane droned overhead.
"You men," the soldier said, "bring your papers to the lieutenant over there by the gate. Now, move."
Antoine kissed Vianne with a gentleness that made her want to cry.
"I love you," he said against her lips.
"I love you too," she said, but the words that always seemed so big felt small now. What was love when put up against war?
"Me too, Papa, me too,"
Sophie cried, flinging herself into his arms. They embraced as a family one last time until Antoine pulled back.
"Goodbye," he said.
Vianne couldn't say it in return. She watched him walk away, watched him merge into the crowd of laughing, talking young men, becoming indistinguishable. The big iron gates slammed shut, the clang of metal reverberating in the hot, dusty air, and Vianne and Sophie stood alone in the middle of the street. Chapter 4. June 1940, France. The medieval villa dominated a deeply green, forested hillside. It looked like something in a confectioner's shop window, a castle sculpted of caramel with spun sugar windows and shutters the color of candied apples. Far below, a deep blue lake absorbed the reflection of the clouds. Manicured gardens allowed the villa's occupants, and more important, their guests, to stroll about the grounds, where only acceptable topics were to be discussed. In the formal dining room, Isabelle Rossignol sat stiffly erect at the white-clothed table that easily accommodated 24 diners. Everything in this room was pale. Walls and floor and ceiling were all crafted of oyster-hued stone. The ceiling arched into a peak nearly 20 feet overhead. Sound was amplified in this cold room, as trapped as the occupants. Madame Dufour stood at the head of the table, dressed in a severe black dress that revealed the soup-spoon-sized hollow at the base of her long neck. A single diamond brooch was her only adornment.
"One good piece, ladies, and choose it well. Everything makes a statement. Nothing speaks quite so loudly as cheapness."
Her narrow face ended in a blunt chin and was framed by curls so obviously peroxided, the desired impression of youth was quite undone. "The trick," she was saying in a cultivated voice, clipped and cut, "is to be completely quiet and unremarkable in your task." Each of the girls at the table wore the fitted blue woolen jacket and skirt that was the school uniform. It wasn't so bad in the winter, but on this hot June afternoon, the ensemble was unbearable. Isabelle could feel herself beginning to sweat, and no amount of lavender in her soap could mask the sharp scent of her perspiration. She stared down at the unpeeled orange placed in the center of her Limoges china plate. Flatware lay in precise formation on either side of the plate. Salad fork, dinner fork, knife, spoon, butter knife, fish fork. It went on and on.
Now, Madame Dufour said, pick up the correct utensils, quietly, s'il vous plaît, quietly, and peel your orange.
Isabel picked up her fork and tried to ease the sharp prongs into the heavy peel, but the orange rolled away from her and bumped over the gilt edge of the plate, clattering the china.
Merde,
she muttered, grabbing the orange before it fell to the floor.
Merde?
Madame Dufour was beside her. Isabel jumped in her seat.
Mon Dieu!
The woman moved like a viper in the reeds.
Pardon, madame,
Isabel said, returning the orange to its place.
Mademoiselle Rossignol, madame said, how is it that you have graced our halls for 2 years and learned so little?
Isabel again stabbed the orange with her fork, a graceless but effective move. Then she smiled up at madame.
Generally, madame, the failing of a student to learn is the failing of the teacher to teach.
Breaths were indrawn all down the table.
Ah, madame said. So we are the reason you still cannot manage to eat an orange properly.
Isabel tried to slice through the peel, too hard, too fast. The silver blade slipped off the puckered peel and clanged on the china plate. Madame Dufour's hand snaked out, her fingers coiled around Isabel's wrist. All up and down the table, the girls watched.
Polite conversation, girls, madame said, smiling thinly. No one wants a statue for a dinner partner.
On cue, the girls began speaking quietly to one another about things that did not interest Isabel. Gardening, weather, fashion. Acceptable topics for women. Isabel heard the girl next to her say quietly,
I am so very fond of Alençon lace, aren't you?
And really, it was all she could do to keep from screaming.
Mademoiselle Rossignol, madame said, you will go see Madame Allard and tell her that our experiment has come to an end.
What does that mean?
She will know. Go.
Isabel scooted back from the table quickly, lest madame change her mind. Madame's face scrunched in displeasure at the loud screech the chair legs made on the stone floor. Isabel smiled.
I really do not like oranges, you know.
Really?
Madame said sarcastically. Isabel wanted to run from this stifling room, but she was already in enough trouble, so she forced herself to walk slowly, her shoulders back, her chin up. At the stairs, which she could navigate with 3 books on her head if required, she glanced sideways, saw that she was alone, and rushed down. In the hallway below, she slowed and straightened. By the time she reached the headmistress's office, she wasn't even breathing hard. She knocked. At Madame's flat,
come in.
Isabel opened the door. Madame Allard sat behind a gilt-trimmed mahogany writing desk. Medieval tapestries hung from the stone walls of the room, and an arched, leaded glass window overlooked gardens so sculpted they were more art than nature. Even birds rarely landed here. No doubt they sensed the stifling atmosphere and flew on. Isabel sat down, remembering an instant too late that she hadn't been offered a seat. She popped back up.
Pardon, madame.
Sit down, Isabel.
She did, carefully crossing her ankles as a lady should, clasping her hands together.
Madame Dufour asked me to tell you that the experiment is over.
Madame reached for one of the Murano fountain pens on her desk and picked it up, tapping it on the desk.
Why are you here, Isabel?
I hate oranges.
Pardon?
And if I were to eat an orange, which, honestly, madame, why would I when I don't like them? I would use my hands like the Americans do, like everyone does, really. A fork and knife to eat an orange?
I mean, why are you at the school?
Oh, that. Well, the convent of the Sacred Heart in Avignon expelled me, for nothing, I might add.
And the Sisters of St. Francis?
Ah, they had reason to expel me.
And the school before that?
Isabel didn't know what to say. Madame put down her fountain pen.
You are almost 19.
Oui, madame.
I think it's time for you to leave.
Isabel got to her feet.
Shall I return to the orange lesson?
You misunderstand.
I mean you should leave the school, Isabel. It is clear that you are not interested in learning what we have to teach you.
How to eat an orange, and when you can spread cheese, and who is more important, the second son of a duke or a daughter who won't inherit, or an ambassador to an unimportant country? Madame, do you not know what is going on in the world?
Isabel might have been secreted deep in the countryside, but still she knew. Even here, barricaded behind hedges and bludgeoned by politeness, she knew what was happening in France. At night, in her monastic cell, while her classmates were in bed, she sat up, long into the night, listening to the BBC on her contraband radio. France had joined Britain in declaring war on Germany, and Hitler was on the move. All across France, people had stockpiled food and put up blackout shades and learned to live like moles in the dark. They had prepared and worried, and then nothing. Month after month, nothing happened. At first, all anyone could talk about was the Great War and the losses that had touched so many families. But as the months went on, and there was only talk of war, Isabel heard her teachers calling it the drôle de guerre, the phony war. The real horror was happening elsewhere in Europe, in Belgium and Holland and Poland.
Will manners not matter in war, Isabel?
They don't matter now,
Isabel said impulsively, wishing a moment later that she'd said nothing. Madame stood.
We were never the right place for you, but
my father would put me anywhere to be rid of me, she said.
Isabel would rather blurt out the truth than hear another lie. She had learned many lessons in the parade of schools and convents that had housed her for more than a decade. Most of all, she'd learned that she had to rely on herself. Certainly her father and her sister couldn't be counted on. Madame looked at Isabel. Her nose flared ever so slightly, an indication of polite but pained disapproval.
It is hard for a man to lose his wife.
It is hard for a girl to lose her mother, she smiled defiantly. I lost both parents, though, didn't I? One died, and the other turned his back on me. I can't say which hurt more.
Mon Dieu, Isabel, must you always speak whatever is on your mind?
Isabel had heard this criticism all her life, but why should she hold her tongue? No one listened to her either way.
So you will leave today. I will telegram your father. Tomas will take you to the train.
Tonight?
Isabel blinked.
But Papa won't want me.
Ah, consequences,
Madame said.
Perhaps now you will see that they should be considered.
Isabel was alone on a train again, heading toward an unknown reception. She stared out the dirty, mottled window at the flashing green landscape. Fields of hay, red roofs, stone cottages, gray bridges, horses. Everything looked exactly as it always had, and that surprised her. War was coming, and she'd imagined it would leave a mark on the countryside somehow, changing the grass color, or killing the trees, or scaring away the birds. But now, as she sat on this train chugging into Paris, she saw that everything looked completely ordinary. At the sprawling Gare de Lyon, the train came to a wheezing, belching stop. Isabel reached down for the small valise at her feet and pulled it onto her lap. As she watched the passengers shuffle past her, exiting the train carriage, the question she'd avoided came back to her. Papa. She wanted to believe.